You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 78 of Take a Bow. I'm your host, Eli Tokash, and we have another great episode. We're taking it back to the Rainbow Lullaby, which we started in the first week of November. We had the creator and we had some writers on last week. And this week, we actually have a writer and performer duo who worked on the same song. And then we also have some more writers. So very exciting stuff. And then next week, we'll have some more performers of the album and singers. So very exciting stuff. This episode, kid you not, is one of my favorites, actually. I really think, especially the conversation that I had with Bobby and Fred was very, very incredibly informative and just really, really great overall, like, conversation. And I personally learned a lot, and I know that you all will too. So I'm excited to push this one out today. I don't know why, but these weeks have felt so long lately that I feel like I haven't talked to you guys in months. Anyways, that's beside the point. We have Joe Lampert, Deborah Marsha, we have Bobby Cronin and Fred Sater on this week's episode. But before we turn it over to them, let's talk about some news, shall we? There's lots of things going on Broadway lately. Obviously, first and foremost, huge, huge congratulations and happy opening to Company, which reopened their previews just this week. And so shout out to them and everyone involved in that production. I've said it a million times. I seriously cannot wait for that production. And if you haven't yet, go listen to the Christopher Sieber episode of Take a Bow, because it had a lot of Company talk in that. And I just am so excited, and I really expressed my excitement in that episode. So hopefully I go see that soon and give you all a little review. But speaking of things that I saw, I actually saw a few shows last week. I saw Freestyle Love Supreme, I saw Trevor, and I saw Moulin Rouge. And I kind of updated y'all on Trevor. I went to the opening night, I went to the red carpet and everything, and I kind of gave like my review there, so I won't talk much about that. I'll quickly glance over Freestyle Love Supreme, because you should really, really go see it. Even if you have seen it, like, it's a completely different show every night. So I think it's really cool to go back and go witness it all again, because you will not be witnessing anything again. And I find that really cool. It was four, this time that I saw it was four completely different artists from the first time that I saw it, which is also incredible, because there's new artists every night. And you never know if there's going to be like special guests or anything, because my friends went the next day or a few days after, and they actually saw Joe Iconis, the composer and writer of Be More Chill, in Freestyle Love Supreme. So that was interesting, and I would have loved to have seen that and seen how that went. But that is a very, very cool show. The audience each night really makes the show. Everything that is said in the audience, everything that the audience does and shouts out is kind of the direction of the show. And it's really brilliant. And I definitely recommend seeing that. And I hope that you have seen it already. And if you have, you know exactly what I'm talking about. And you know exactly, you feel the exact same way that I do, and that you should go back. And then Moulin Rouge, I don't know. This is a little bit of an unpopular opinion. I loved it, okay? Don't get me wrong. I absolutely loved it. I thought it was brilliant. I thought it definitely deserved to win Best Musical. However, like, you know, like, it's as if you're going to, like, a club. Like, it's as if you're going to the Moulin Rouge Club. So it's not like, I don't know. People were describing it to me as, like, the best piece of theater that they've ever seen. And, like, yes, it was absolutely brilliant. It was absolutely unique. I love how they had, like, it was kind of like a jukebox in a way that they just had a bunch of songs like into a story that already existed. And I thought it was really cool, just everything about it. But I don't know if it was like the best show that I've ever seen, you know. It's definitely up there, but I feel like I could think of a few that I enjoyed more. Obviously the Moulin Rouge story like isn't anything like crazy. It's just the spectacle of it all that really sells it and makes it so enjoyable. That being said, I'm really, really not like hating on Moulin Rouge because I absolutely enjoyed it. Danny Burstein is absolutely brilliant in the role. Aaron Tveit is incredible. His voice, unbelievable. And so like everyone involved is insanely talented and everything. And I really enjoyed the show, but I don't know. I don't think it was the best that I've ever seen. But I don't know. I don't know. I'm getting a little nervous talking about it right now, so I'm just going to move on. But there's exciting news. Obviously, this past week as well, there was a Spring Awakening reunion. It was the talk of New York and social media and Broadway TikTok and everything. And luckily enough, for everyone that didn't or that wasn't able to see Spring Awakening, they are going to be able to see the reunion documentary in 2022 because HBO is putting it on. They don't have an exact date yet, but we will be able to see the Spring Awakening reunion documentary. I don't know if it's going to be the whole performance or if it's just like kind of like a documentary of like the behind the scenes of it all, but that's all going to be produced by HBO, and that's coming in 2022, which really sounds far away, but guys, we are 2 months, not even, away from 2022, which is just absolutely crazy. And some other really fun news. Tick Tick Boom is actually coming out tomorrow, Friday. This is insane. And so everybody's been doing press about that. Reviews have been coming out about that. Actors are going on The Tonight Show and all of that. So it's been really fun to see once again this musical brand get so highlighted in the media, and it's a really focal point right now, so I'm really excited to see it. I've seen mixed reviews. Same with Dear Evan Hansen though, so like I'm not getting my hopes down. I'm still gonna go see it. I'm very excited. The cast is incredible. And yeah, it's Tick Tick Boom, guys. Like it's gonna be good, I promise. I also want to send out another congratulations to Chicago as they hit their 25th anniversary performance this week. There is so much happening on Broadway. So Chicago hit their 25th anniversary performance. It was 25 years on Broadway since it opened and everything. So they had a brilliant night of celebration, and a lot of the old cast came back. And it looked like amazing. I don't know. I saw so many videos and photos and read a bunch of stuff about it, and a few of my friends went and everything. So it was really cool to see how they did that. And that's a huge milestone. Shows it's hard to last over a year on Broadway. So 25 years is pretty spectacular. And I just want to send out a huge shout out and a huge congratulations to Chicago because, I mean, they definitely deserve it. That's like, that's real. That's the real deal right there. So once again, congrats, Chicago. And I'm excited to go see that again. I haven't seen it in a while, and I feel like when I saw it, I didn't understand it completely, or is a little like too old for me. I don't know. But yes, nonetheless, I want to go see it again. And I want to see this new cast because they seem to have a new cast like every like month in a way. So like I said, lots of stuff happening. I kind of shared everything that I wanted to share already. With that's kind of all I have for us this week for the news. Without further ado, let's turn it over to the interview. Curtain up on the Rainbow Lullaby Part 2. J
Joining us first this week are two award-winning lyricists and composers who wrote a combined 4 songs in the Rainbow Lullaby album. Everyone, welcome to Take a Bow, Fred Sauter and Bobby Cronin.
Howdy. Hey.
Yes, this is so exciting. I'm so excited to be here. I told Fred a little bit about it, but I talked to Ryan the first interview like I had, and he explained to me, or he asked me what my favorite songs were, and the 2 songs that I actually said, and I had no idea at the time that either of you wrote it, was Go to Sleep and As Bright as a Star. And Ryan was like, you chose 2 songs that I didn't write. And I was like, I'm so sorry. So like afterwards, I was like, oh, maybe I should see who wrote it. But now I have both of you together and I'm so excited. So tell me kind of both how you got involved in this project and what inspired you both to get involved. Fred, do you want to start?
Yeah, sure. Well, Ryan approached me last November, right when he got the idea to do the album. Well, I think he actually had the idea for many years, but that's when he started really making it actually come to fruition. And so we started bouncing some ideas and writing songs for each other and just like giving feedback and that sort of thing. And I know that he wanted it to be a bigger album with a lot of composers and a big project, and then so we got an appointment with Broadway Records and pitched it to them, and they were really into it. So at that point, it was just getting everybody else on board.
Oh my God! So you kind of have been with it like since the very beginning.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah.
Oh my God! I had no idea. I didn't realize that you pitched it to Broadway Records with him. That's awesome.
Yeah.
Bobby, what about you?
Ryan messaged me. And asked, well, my piano is on. Sorry, Ryan messaged me and asked if I would write something for it. And when he explained what it was, I was like, count me in. Yes,
yeah.
Absolutely, 100%, whatever you need.
That's
so, and then we sort of floated with the idea of, he said that he had some lyrics, do I want to put lyrics, music to some of his lyrics? And I thought, you know, let me read through some. And then I just had this idea and decided to jump out on my own.
Amazing. Yeah, I noticed Ryan has a few of those kind of on the album, like, you know, he has the lyrics and then someone puts music to it. And they're brilliant. All of them, all of the songs in this album are so beautiful and so brilliant and elegant. I love this album. I was telling Fred on it before you joined, but I do. I love it. Fred, you wrote 3 songs for this album. Crazy. Like, that's like second most to Ryan, which makes sense because you guys have both been in it from the beginning. Talk to me about, like, did you have all of these different ideas from the beginning? Did it kind of just like come as you were writing and you were like, oh, I have another song that I want to write? Like, was it the plan all along? How did it work?
It really happened pretty fast, actually. Like, right when we started writing the songs and kind of passing them back and forth. Just, you know, for the feedback, like,
sure.
It was, like, bam, it was just an explosion. I think I wrote all 3 probably within, like, 2 weeks or a week or something like that. And I actually wrote a few more, but then, like, I was like, these are not up to par. So those are the 3 that I thought were the best for this project. But, yeah, all of them were original and written directly for this.
Wow. Okay. Interesting. So you got, did that happen to you too, Bobby? Like, I know, like, as writers, I mean, sometimes that happens where you write a bunch of songs and then you scrap it and you start fresh or some don't make it or whatever.
Yeah. I had initially sent a different song.
Really?
And yes, but in it, I used the lyrics Mommy and Daddy.
Oh.
And Ryan, he wrote me back and he's like, I don't know if you're misunderstanding the assignment.
Right.
And I was like, oh my God, I don't know why I did what I did. So then what I did was I sat and I thought, if I had a child, what would I want to tell the child? And and I don't mean this as a dig to my parents at all, but what do I wish had been said to me? And I just jumped off and I actually wrote the music and lyrics together at this very same time. Which
what?
I don't normally do that, But because it was a lullaby, I knew it needed to be short. I knew it needed to not be too riffy or too belty, or and I knew I was writing it for Jelani. I had, when Ryan asked me, he's the first person, well, he's actually the second person I reached out. The first person was Al Morgan Lee, but Al Morgan was already on, she already had said yes to somebody else. So I just worked with Jelani, asked Jelani, and he said, count me in. So I knew his voice quite well and just kept hearing him singing the piece. And in fact, once we got into the recording studio, I made even more changes.
Really?
Yeah, because I was like, oh no, what if you go up there instead? Because we could play, like we had the time to play yes. around. And so the ending is not even close to what I originally wrote. It's close, but his voice is just so pretty. I wanted to show it off a little bit more. His voice, so I decided to go up.
Incredible. I love that magic happens in the recording.
Yeah.
I love that.
And then having Yaz there in the room, he was so helpful as well. Because I kept being like, can we dot that quarter note instead? Can we, let's make it a half note. Because it was, you write something, during quarantine, I've written so many different things for, not really quarantine anymore, we're COVID, let's call it COVID, things that are not theater.
Oh.
And like I did audio dramas, I did podcasts, I did just stuff that I hadn't really done too much of before. And so when this came across my plate, it was like, okay, I have to do this, like sort of putting it in order. So when I got to it, I was like, okay, this is I think of the dots on the page as like a blueprint. Mm-hmm. And when I work with a singer, I try to tailor it for A, what I hear, but B, like, oh, that is a sweet spot in your voice. No, let's hold that a little longer. I don't like the scansion there. Let's change that scansion. So I like to play with the singers, and knowing it was Jelani and having Yaz there, who's also a composer, we were able to try like different takes. And then I think we actually put together something that's from a couple of different takes for it to be like, that's how I hear it in my head.
That's so fascinating. So I want to ask a question, because this was actually part of my questions and you kind of led right into it. But for both of you, Bobby, we can stick with you first because we're kind of on this topic with you. Is it kind of easier knowing who you're writing for when you're writing a song?
Yes. Me, I will say for me it is. Every show that I write, I sort of star cast it in my head.
Wow.
Like I have a show called Mary and Max, and the first name that I said for Max was Shuler Hensley.
Oh.
And Shuler has done readings, and he's doing this concert I'm doing tomorrow. And it was easier to go, okay, that's the range that he lives in. Try not to go above that. Also, Mary, I was writing it specifically for one of my best friends, Lauren Elder, who is in Hair and Sideshow. And Lauren has this really crazy instrument in that she has like an old school belt where like a men's G or A is such a huge note for her, yet she has this crazy soprano.
Mm.
So I decided for the character of Mary, I was like, great, she's an old school belter. She's not going to sing anything higher than a B.
Wow.
And so it did help. There are other characters that I imagine, like Beth Level in one of them. Sometimes for other shows, I have a show with teenagers. I'm clearly not a teenager. And I just imagine, what I hear in the radio of what the vocal range would be.
Yeah.
And put that in there and think of, I also write characters that are sort of non-gender conforming, so I get to play with range. And to answer your question, yes, it does help. And for me, amazing. Specifically, yeah.
Fred, what about you?
Sure. Well, I can start with when I'm writing for a musical, it really is more specifically about a certain voice and a certain voice type. And often I do star casting as well with my call, we generally like, okay, this is Ariana Grande's voice that we hear for this song, whatever, and we'll kind of write it for that type of voice, and then find an actor who can match that or is of a similar vibe. And then, you know, and in the case of, like, I wrote a show called Bed Bugs, and, you know, we worked with a few of the actors early on. Yeah, Brian Charles Rooney and Chris Hall, who were in the very first reading, and we had written, as we continued to work on the piece, we wrote more and more for their voices. The same goes for Rip, like, after hearing how Brian delivered lines, like, I knew how to write them, at, you know, it was just very in sync for him. Specific.
Because when you get an actor like someone like Brian, whose range is, like, my hands don't even fit on the screen, his range is enormous. You get to really play. It's super fun.
Absolutely. And so for this, I actually wrote the songs as songs. I wasn't necessarily picking up a voice type, except for the fact that the case of Don't You Cry, I definitely knew it was two men, because it's about, you know, a gay couple adopting a child or a baby. And for Rain, I was thinking I would like to have it be sung by a transgender person, and I was blessed to have two wonderful transgender people sing on the album, so that's great. And then for Go to Sleep, actually, that could be sung by anyone. So we got Chris and Clay, who did a fantastic job, but that's not specific to any gender or type. You know, you can do a lot with that song.
Oh my God, yeah, absolutely. And I've told you already, that's literally, like, one of my favorite songs on the whole album. It's just, like, the message and the writing with Chris and Clay's voice, incredible. They're so talented. Really, everyone on the album.
They're so good. They're so good.
This album is, like, star-studded, you know, like, everyone on this album, there's not, like, a bad song, there's not a poorly sung song, like, everyone is so brilliant, and it's wonderful. And I love that it features all LGBTQ performers and artists, which is even more brilliant, and it just kind of adds that layer of specialness, I guess, to the album and to the project in general. I think it's really cool what Ryan and even you guys have really done with this project.
Yeah. I agree.
Yeah, and I can't believe that it hasn't been done before. It's incredible. But I want to talk because I noticed with a lot of both of your work, your respected works, like, outside of this project, you guys have, like, partners, I guess, when you're writing, like, a musical. You know, you kind of take care of the music and lyrics, and someone does the books. But I want to talk about, like, as you as a writer and as an individual, like, artist writing a new show, is that kind of something that how does that work, that partnership, and how does that how do you choose who you want to work with, and how does that, like, come about?
That's a great question. I've been blessed to have met a wonderful woman named Crystal Skillman. We were friends for years. She was a downtown playwright who kept getting rave reviews in the New York Times. And she loves comic books. And I said to her one day, and she loves musicals. And I said to her one day, have you ever thought of writing a musical? And she was like, what? No, I don't know how to do it. What? I mean, yes, wait, maybe I should. So we have worked on two projects together. We're currently pitching an animated musical series as well.
God.
Yeah, it's just one of those things that during quarantine, or COVID, whatever it's called, we were like, okay, so our shows are stalled. What can we be doing? And I had this idea that I thought was a musical, and she was like, no, that's a cartoon. And I was like, great, let's do it.
Wow.
So, but then I have other collaborators that I've worked with. Christine Toy Johnson, I got paired with to write a short film, and we just worked so well together that we wrote a musical together. For that one, I only wrote the music. And sometimes I like doing that. And sometimes I do write the book myself. So it all depends. I have a great collaborator named Caroline Prue on another project that was supposed to have its world premiere in San Diego in May of 2020. The sets are already being built. But it's okay. And she and I saw a play of hers off Broadway, and I loved it. And she happened to be there that night. And I pitched her this idea that I had, not knowing that she was exactly the right person to write. It's a Southern, I'm not Southern, I'm not super Christian, and it's a Southern Christian idea that I had. Wow. She is both of those things. And with her, within 6 months, we had won our first award on the piece. So I love working with women. That is something one thing I will say. I just like having another point of view with it. So I think that answers that.
Yeah. What about you? What's your thought process through that, Fred?
Sure. Well, I went to NYU and for the musical theater writing program. In that program, you get paired with every other person, like with the first year. So you get to experience creating with all different types of people in different scenarios. And I feel like I love collaborating and I love new experiences. But when you find somebody you work well with, you continue to work with them. And so that was the case with Paul Leshin, who we met in 2007 just through a mutual friend. And we started coming up with the idea of Bedbugs the same day that we met, actually. And then we've written 4 other shows since, you know, and the newest one is called Small Pond, and that's an animated film idea that we're still working on, you know, developing. So
I love this. Lots of similarities between you two.
And then I'm also working with Brett Macias, who is
I love Brett.
You know Brett?
I love him.
Yeah, he's wonderful. So Brett is a composer.
I know his wife very well.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Wonderful, yeah. So we went to NYU together. That's where we wrote our 20 minute together there.
Cool.
We had talked about working on this craft show idea for years, and then we finally started working on it like before the pandemic, and we're kind of like back to it again. But you know, it's like one of those things where the pandemic just messed up everything. Well, is theater ever going to happen again? Should I work on this?
Right.
But you know, we plow through, and we actually did a performance of one of the songs in Times Square back in March. Actually, Cicely sang on it. So that, yeah,
cool.
Yeah, that's very cool. But yeah, that's about a craft show, and all
amazing
the people involved in that lifestyle. So it's very fun.
Did you write that New Orleans piece with Brett?
I did not. No.
Okay. That's a cool show. Yeah, I saw that reading. It was great. Cicely was amazing.
Yeah.
Well, I want to talk to you guys. We'll have a couple more questions and then I'll let you go because I know we have to go. I want to talk to you both about your writing influencers and kind of how that, you know, as an actor and as a performer, I have a lot of actor performing and whatnot. Like, I have a lot of those influencers and not writers. So I want to know, like, how that affects your work as a writer and what you kind of take from them and how you look for that. And I don't know, like, talk to me about like a writing influence that you have. Fred, we'll start with you.
Well, I definitely come more from the rock world. You know, I did a lot of studying of rock history from the 60s through the 90s, I guess you could say, through the present. And so that influences a lot, but also, you know, I also have mad respect for Stephen Sondheim and classical musical theater, and especially, you know, the concept albums of the 70s, Sondheim and Kander and Ebb and all of those. And so, you know, and that form and perfect rhyme and all of that comes with classical musical theater is definitely a part of what influences me, but I also aesthetically kind of prefer the sound of rock and pop. So it's really always about blending those two things and finding new ways. And you know, in the case of Small Pond, there's actually some hip hop songs. So I'm delving into other styles as well because, you know, it's good to be current and modern.
I had to ask, cause this is like mind blowing to me as someone who like has a lot of rock influences and like loves rock. Did you ever think you would be writing lullabies?
Oh, that's funny. That's really funny. No, it's not something I necessarily thought of. It was, I love a project. I love like a challenge and I love a theme and like working within a theme. And when somebody gives me a challenge, like this is what the thing is, I'm like, I just immediately brainstorm and I'm like, this is
right.
How can I like make this work? And boom.
Yeah, it's like once you know the box.
Yeah, I like the limits.
Or the parameter, yeah.
Parameters of like, that goes for anything, you know, any project. So,
I love that. Bobby, what about you?
I think, Fred, you and I are the same human being. I grew up in a large Irish Catholic family with seven of us with one bathroom. So I shared a room with two of my brothers. Oh, so we had all these different musical styles going through my house. And like my dad loved the doo-wop stuff. My mom liked musical theater. My brother was a metalhead. My other brother liked Neil Diamond. A sister liked like Pat Benatar. Another sister liked Fleetwood Mac. So I had this crazy stuff, which is why I was such a sought after pop rock coach, because I know all the stuff from it. The stuff I'm weakest at is modern. Well, that not I shouldn't say modern, but today. But that's not true because I love listening to the radio. But anyway, so my greatest influence is Queen, number one, and Elton John. Like Freddie Mercury is just my hero. I just, the way that he could take something and make it soar, but give it like grit at the same time, and have different melodic themes throughout. But I love Jerry Herman, because he takes a tune and he makes you remember that tune. And I love his key changes, and I love how the songs forward the story sometimes, but I also like how the songs sort of like live in a moment for a bit. Mm-hmm. And yes, I'm like everybody, I'm a huge Sondheim fan. But if I also, I'm a huge, huge Jason Robert Brown fan.
Oh yeah.
And it's weird because I don't write like him, because I don't play the piano like him. Because I never had lessons. It was just, we never had money, so I taught myself. So I can't do the stuff that he does. I write more melody first. I'm all the tune. But there was some, I remember hearing Jason Robert Brown's work the first time and being like, oh my God, he's writing monologues in song, like song monologues. And it just sort of changed how I saw what music can do in a musical.
Wow. Amazing. Can I ask you one more before you leave?
Yeah.
It's just, we're going to stay on in this. How does, like, I kind of asked it before, but how does it, those influences like Elton John, but like also Jason Robert Brown and everything, like how does that influence you to write something for like a project like this, like the Rainbow Lullaby? Like, is there tunes that you kind of take from them? Is there words, a story? Like how, like what do you kind of take from them to do in your work, I guess?
I think for this, nothing other than, this was super personal. And maybe that's why, like my mom can't stop listening to the song. It's her favorite song of mine I've ever written. And I guess it's because it's not for a character in a way. You know, we get really good at writing for characters. And every so often we get to write just to write. And I think so the influences came in maybe with like song structure, or you know, sort of the false ending going into a little coda melody type thing. But in my other work, definitely. Like any show that I have, I sort of theme it. This is my rock show. This is my country gospel show. This is my contemporary musical theater show. Helps me, because the way I write sometimes, I just sit at the piano and just start messing around, and I'll come up with something and be like, oh, I really like that. Does a show need this? Oh, it feels more like this piece. Or if I play with it a little more, it would feel more like this piece. Mm. But I think my fingers just go to, I don't know if you're the same way, Fred, but my fingers go to what I grew up playing, which was the Elton John chord progressions, the Queen chord progressions. The Queen stole so much, or borrowed so much from classical, that there's stuff that I didn't even know I was doing that was classically based until I went to college and actually studied music.
Wow.
Yeah, I think the influences come through often without me even realizing it. I think that's probably true for a lot of writers and composers, that it's just in you. It's what's in you. It's what's in your soul and in your blood, and it's just how it comes out. And like in the case of this album, again, I don't think there was any specific influence for any of those songs, the three. It's just, they just kind of came out, honestly. Yeah.
Wow. Right. That tends to happen though, right? Like it just comes out.
Yeah.
And I learned from Lynn Ahrens of Ahrens and Flaherty that she says that when she sits that she will say, "Okay, talk to me."
What?
And yeah, and that you hope, and Stephen Flaherty was a mentor as well, which is how she told me the story, but where it's just that I don't know, I believe someone sings in my head. But I think that comes from all the music that's stuck in there from listening to so much. Yeah. Like I can't think of when I'm not listening to music. I go for a walk, I listen to the music. I go for a car ride, I listen to music. I'm cleaning my house, I'm listening to music.
Literally.
And I try to listen to something radically different every time as well.
Wow.
Yeah, for me, it just hits. It just hits like a melody or a hook. Usually just hits like when I'm, you know, walking a dog or something. I had a dog walking business before I...
Nice.
I was like doing something like that where it's like something very commonplace or that's... You know, that doesn't really require your brain. Just my brain just starts working automatically, and boom, I have to get my phone out and record it into
same.
The phone, and then when I get home, figure out the chords or, you know, take it to the level. So, yeah.
Well, you guys are absolutely fascinating. I could literally talk to you all day. I love seeing how writers' minds work because I'm like, I wish I like. Could just sit, I don't know. I wish I could write. And but yeah, I think what you guys have said is absolutely brilliant. Your songs are brilliant. Go check them out. Rain, 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 Don't You Cry, As Bright as a Star, Go to Sleep. It's also good. Check it out on the Rainbow Lullaby, literally anywhere you listen to music. Bobby, good luck at your show tomorrow with
Thank
Kate
you very
Bakla,
much.
Kelly Young, all of these stars, Jelani, all of these stars. It's so exciting. Thank you so much for doing this, and I'm very, very lucky to have met both of you. So have a great day, everyone.
Thank you for having us.
Of course. Joining us now is an award-winning composer and associate conductor, Deborah Barsha, and both a stage and screen veteran, Joe Lampert, who collaborated together in Mommy and Mama in the Rainbow Lullaby album. So welcome, everyone, and thanks for doing this.
Thank you for having us.
Of course. Yes. So obviously, I mean, from what it seems like from this little short time we've been on Zoom, you guys know each other before doing this. So where did your relationship begin? And then how did you two get involved in the Rainbow Lullaby?
Deborah, you go. I mean, you were involved in it first. So,
okay.
Yeah.
So first thing that happened was Joe auditioned for a show directed by Diane Paulus called Prometheus Bound. Mm-hmm. And it was at ART up in Boston. Yeah. And when she came into the audition in New York, we freaked out, basically. Oh. And we said, I don't know what she's going to be, but she has to be in the show. She has to be in the show.
Oh my
so
God.
That's that. I was a fan from day one. Let's put it that way. And I music directed that. And Joe was in it. And from there, we did a crazy children's camp together.
Amazing.
Where we lived in this lesbian couple's basement and then went to the Bay Street Theater in Sag Harbor and did this theater camp. And then we just kept flowing in and out of each other's house. We did a Steven Sater, Burt Bacharach musical called New York Animals together. What else did we do together, Joe?
We did the camp. We did New York Animals at the New Ohio West Village area.
Yeah.
I've done a workshop of one of Deborah's former shows that is now actually getting a new life, which is about the life of Keith Haring.
It's called Radiant Baby. It's going to be at Two River Theater this summer.
Amazing.
But more important than that, besides the Rainbow Lullaby album, right before Joe and I, Long Wharf Theater kind of commissioned us in some kind of a way, right? Mm-hmm. To do a piece. And we live streamed this piece for Long Wharf Theater, and it was called Conversations with Ourselves. And it was just about, you can actually watch it and see our whole story together and how we totally get each other. And we feel related to each other on some way on the planet.
I love that. So then did Ryan get in touch with you, Deborah, and basically ask you to write a song?
Yes, because I think Fred Sauter, who I know really well, I music directed Bedbugs in one of its incarnations.
Yes.
Yeah, Fred and Ryan knew each other, so I saw that he was part of it. So I didn't know how Ryan got my name, but anyway, he did. And I said, oh, I would love to do that, because one of my piano students called her parents, our lesbian parents, Mama and Mommy. And I said, wouldn't that be nice to have a song, like a lullaby for a kid with two mommies?
Absolutely.
I wanted to make it really, really, here's what I wanted to do. Make it so accessible that anyone can sing it. It wouldn't have to be like whatever, like a mother could sing it, even if they had a bad voice or whatever. I just wanted it to be a soothing little thing. And I thought of Joe right away, because Joe has the ability to be a chameleon. She can change her voice for whatever's needed. Isn't that true, Joe? You know that's true.
I mean, Deborah knows that I'm not going to say anything nice about myself, so don't ask me.
But that was it. I thought of Joe immediately, because I said, you know what? She'll get it. Just not from a queer perspective, but what I want. And I didn't put any harmony on it. I didn't want a lot of stuff on it. I wanted it to feel, you know, like a child would be soothed by this, by anybody singing this. So I thought Joe would be the perfect person. And then I got in touch with Joe, and Joe did it.
Wow. Joe, I have to say, your voice on this song is so good. It's like perfect.
Oh, well, that's very sweet. I was actually just re-listening to it just so that I could like be in touch with what we were talking about.
Oh, my God.
You know, it's funny, like I added, it does feel like a different part of my voice, because it was such a simple, simple, and I don't mean that in a negative way, I mean that very positively. It's a very beautiful, simple, as lullabies need to be, because they need to be kind of like both cathartic, but not excitable, so that a child can fall asleep to it and be feel warmed and safe by it. And so it had this very pure tone, and I was like not sure how to approach it really. And so there is a lot of like vibrato in there, just like to kind of like, it like felt like inhabiting the character of somebody who actually had a child and was singing to them, and like what that tone needed to be. You know what I mean?
Absolutely.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I think I'm sorry. But when I was younger, I wish that there had been something like this. And I think it's very inspiring, and especially the way Ryan conceived of it after his mother's passing. But anyway, what were you going to ask? I'm sorry.
No, that was beautiful. I was just wanting to go back to what you were saying earlier. We just spoke to Fred last week, and he was talking about you, actually. So like, I was very excited to be able to talk to you like here today, because I was telling him that I was interviewing you at some point, and he was like, oh my gosh, I love her. Send me her my love and everything. And of course, I know Diane, because I did Pippin in Finding Neverland with her. So Diane is a very special person to me as well. So yeah, it's
great.
So funny how this is going full circle right now. And you kind of alluded to it, but I want to talk about what inspired both of you as individuals, not only to work with each other, but also just like the story that is being told in the Rainbow Lullaby. Like, how special is that, that it made you want to just like fall in love with it and be a part of it?
Go ahead, Joe. Oh, I just wanted to say, just having queer composers and queer singers, to me, this is like revolutionary, because people don't always, in all of our worlds on this planet, associate children. This is a relatively recent phenomenon,
right?
To have children involved in the LGBTQIA+ community. And what were you going to say, Joe?
Yeah, I mean, I was going to say, like, I was lucky enough to get to sing on two separate songs, which was kind of a surprise and completely random. It was not intentional. And sort of between those and listening to some of the others, yeah, I mean, I think it's extremely inspiring to think about, well, first of all, Ryan's story.
Right.
The reason why, you know, that he decided to make this album inspired by his mother, who he, you know, lost recently, but also the person who recorded us, his friend, is also, you know, queer with a child. And like, so the whole recording atmosphere too was really inspiring, because it was a person who, I'm not going to go into his story, but he has his own whole story about, like, you know, family and acceptance and having a child and having a partner and what that means in other cultural traditions. And I think what's really so beautiful about this album is that, like, as Deb said, you can write it toward a place where anybody could sing any of these songs and it would still resonate, but that it is so specifically about the Home of Three and Mommy and Mama are obviously about these, you know, co-parenting situations that are, you know, between two women or between two, you know, just a queer relationship. And I just never heard anything like that. I've never you know, you could think back to like from my age, the 80s, like Raffi. It's not to say that there aren't some great collective songs we all know from childhood, but to actually have an album that is by, for, and surrounding queer themes is like pretty extraordinary.
I know. I was talking to Ryan and I couldn't believe that this like didn't exist in some capacity. Like, it's mind blowing. And like, I'm so grateful that now it does exist. And now we have this beautiful album. Literally, there's not like one album, not one song on the album that like isn't just equally impactful in its own way. It's sharing a different story. It's really brilliant. So I'm really happy that this now exists and now that you guys are a part of it as well. So Deb, when you wrote this song, I know you had mentioned that you had reached out to Joe, but when you were writing it, did you kind of write it like in a way for Joe and for her voice?
I kind of did. I didn't tell her because I don't like to freak her out. But what I did was Ryan immediately said, I have an idea of who should sing this, because he asked me while I was writing it. I sent like this little demo first of me singing it. Sure. And he said, do you have an idea who could sing this? I said, Joe Lampert. I have to get Joe Lampert to do it. It was like immediate. I knew it was right. And mm-hmm. so I tried to write it in Joe's key. And it worked out. I said, Joe, is this good for your, do you like this key? And she said, yeah, it's fine. But we did talk.
Classic Joe Lampert form, it took me like months to get back to Deb about just like a very simple ask, like, is it the right key? And then it's like day of recording and she's still like, is it the right key?
And then the great thing about, Joe and I have this, we just know each other on the planet. It's very strange. It's really strange, actually, because our, the way we communicate is like, I nag her. And then she says, are you going to nag me? And I go, yes, I'm going to nag you until you give me an answer. And then she gives me an answer.
Oh, I love that. Sometimes it's all you need. It's okay. It works.
But we have that kind of friendship. We can talk to each other any way we want. That's what our show's about anyway.
Well, it's funny because I was like, well, Deb's song, like I was like, it feels super simple. But actually, there's this transition to that little bridge section or like the B section. Where it's like da 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 da. And for some reason, I actually found that very that transition was not intuitive to me, which is funny. I don't know why I couldn't. It just was like, I did have to do that take separately because like it was funny because I was like, well, certainly I know where the song is going, but like in classic Deborah form, like there's always complexity in her writing, even when it is something that comes across as kind of like effortless and simple. So
Joe, as a singer, talk about that. Like, how do you navigate that? And what do you have to like work on and do necessarily to get it into the right place?
I've been realizing recently that I'm a very visual learner. Like when I first started singing, you know, the most backup that I started doing or like solos and things that I started singing in the past was with my friend Shayna Taub. So Shayna would record and she would, if it was like a wrong note that she accidentally sang, she'd be like, no, forget that. Don't learn that. Because I tend to glue when I'm listening by ear to like the thing that I first hear.
Right.
So what I've been noticing lately is when I get some music, whether if it doesn't have sheet music or if it, you know, then I'll do my own version of it by just playing it out on the keyboard and just writing notes and little arrows to understand the relationship between notes. Just, it's an easier way for me to learn almost with a visual map. And then sheet music is also obviously an obvious way, but you don't always get that. I try to make the song visual in order for me to understand shifts and changes. It's just something I've learned about myself recently, like quick turnover demos like this or quick, you know, recordings like this, where it's like, it's a one-off, it's a couple hours. And I'm also learning two songs and recording two songs within that time period. Just having notes there. It's like almost like hieroglyphics. Nobody would know what I'm writing out.
Right.
Just my own way of like writing a map, you know?
Totally. Well, talk to me too, because you also did Home of Three, which is the other song that you did on the Rainbow Lullaby with Lauren Patton. So what was it like to, I mean, obviously you sang a song solo and then you also sang one as a duet. So like, what is kind of like the difference and like how the voices mesh together and everything like that?
Well, we were lucky. Lauren and Zoe are friends of mine. And so we were, and Deborah has been really busy lately. And like, she also lives out of town. So it was, we were lucky because Lauren and Zoe, we were able to get into a space together and kind of like look at the sheet music, figure out who should sing what part, because it was divided in a very particular way, but we then sort of changed certain things when I was like, oh, Lauren's voice sounds better on this B, like, let's put her there, you know?
Sure.
And so that was an interesting process because we did get in the room with Zoe, and we actually recorded the duet first, and then I did Deborah's song after. And yeah, that's delicate because like there were a lot of lines where we needed to match in rhythm, but the but our timbres are completely different. And Zoe really liked that and was trying to embrace that. But there was a delicacy to trying to match, not timbre, but like timing, because some of it was a little bit languid. And so like it wasn't super rhythmic. So there was that. But then I was warmed up to get into Deborah's song. So that,
right.
that was Deborah's. But then I also kind of had to change characters because I felt like it was a different gay mom singing in Deborah's song than was singing.
Totally.
In Zoe's song, you know, so yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Everybody doesn't get to hear Joe's voice quite that way that she approached my song with and didn't ask me, by the way. And I was so happy. I said, I really want you to make it your own. Approach it the way you feel that this character singing to a child would approach it. And she did.
Wow. And it works. It's amazing. It really turned out beautifully.
I'm so happy she did it. Thank you, Joe. I never really said thank you, but thank you.
No, you 100% thanked me a million times over. Don't discount your thank yous. It was actually a really, really fun day. I mean, both Lauren and I were like on our way to like separate places. So like it was a pretty quick turnover. And I'm blanking on his name right now, the amazing producer.
Yaz? Was it Yaz? Was it Yaz? Is that his studio?
Oh, yeah. Yasuhiko, but yeah, I think you're right.
We called him Yaz.
Yes.
Yep.
Oh, yeah. Amazing. Shout out
Yaz. He's phenomenal. I didn't get to meet his partner and his child, but like there was so much love in that space that he's created, and there were dogs. It was just a really beautiful atmosphere, home studio. So it was awesome.
Oh, I love that.
Well, and then the cello was put on with, they just said, hey, do you want to write a cello part for this? We have a cellist that's going to do some of the songs. I said, sure. And I wrote a cello part and I forgot who that cellist is, but can we look him up and give him a shout out? Because it was unbelievable. The cello
part.
Yeah,
I don't know who that is, but we'll find out.
All right. Well, okay.
Well, Deborah, while she's looking that up, like what is the kind of the differences of writing for like a vocalist and like a cellist?
Oh, it's very different.
Yeah, I'm sure.
First of all, yeah, once I heard the concept that there was going to be a cellist, I was like, oh, that's so great.
Actually, tell Eli about when you wrote for me for three voices and cello.
Right. So Joe said, yes, that's right. That was the first time I wrote for cello, actually. Joe was doing, what was it called, Joe? It was at Ars Nova?
I did a like a cabaret, like a one night evening of Magpie Melodies, which was like covers that were all reimagined and rearranged and reinterpreted by friends for my voice.
Right, so she asked me to do My Funny Valentine. And I said, oh, I have an idea. Can we do it for three voices? We have three background singers or two?
Two
background singers, Joe and a cello.
Wow.
That was it. And I thought that would be so beautiful if the cello acted like an accompanist. And so I did this version of My Funny Valentine. So I'd already written for cello. And I just thought, wouldn't this be great for the lullaby? Because
The cellist is Bobby L. Crow III.
Thank you. That's who the cellist was. on the lullaby album. Thank you. Let's really put something out there about him because I think he did like a lot of the songs. Either he wrote the cello.
He did.
Yeah. Well, so
yeah, and it was beautiful. It's amazing how these things can be recorded from afar. Like none of us needs to be in a room.
Right.
I'm in grad school for this like sound production stuff and it's fascinating. So much can be done like postal service style, like across the country, you know?
It's insane. Yeah.
And I'm in the Hilton Garden Inn right now. 48th and 8th. I'm in the lobby. But anyway, yes, I love that we're doing this. And I want to talk about the album. I want to get the word out there. I've been retweeting and reposting everything that Ryan puts up. Because I'm just really proud of it. And I'm proud to be in the company of the other composers because they're really fantastic.
Absolutely. Everyone is so talented. Like I said, I mean, every song is a new story, but like just impactful and just as meaningful. So yep. I appreciate you guys and your spending your afternoon with me as you are on your way to your show, Deborah. Break a leg at Tina, by the way. You're welcome. Just thank you for talking to me and spreading the word of the Rainbow Lullaby. I really appreciate it. And it was so nice meeting you. So have a great day.
Thank you, Eli.
Thanks for having us. Thanks to Ryan for including us.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Shout out, Ryan.
Such an amazing, beautiful concept. Something the world 100% needed. And I just know how absolutely proud his mother would be.
Oh, absolutely. Yes.
Thank you, Ryan, so much.
Well, thank you guys as well.
All right. Thanks, Eli.
Bye. Take a Bow, Rainbow Lullaby Part 2, and really everyone who's involved in this incredible project. It's really, really impactful and just special, this project. And every time that I hear, I talk to new people about it, it's just like, it makes me that much more excited about the project. And it's just, it's a really cool thing, and I'm really glad that we now have it. Huge shout out to Ryan Bauer Welsh, who obviously we talked about a lot on here, and continue to give shout outs. So I'm really grateful that everyone was willing to give me their time. Deborah Marsha, huge shout out to you in making this work. We did this on Wednesday, literally yesterday, if you're listening to this on the day it comes out, at 12:15, right before her show, so we don't have to do it in between her shows. And she did it, like she said, at the Hilton at a hotel in the lobby, so it could be like quiet because she was going to be on the streets of New York otherwise. But huge shout out to everyone who's making these contributions and sharing the getting the message out of this project and sharing its story. It's really, really great. And you can tell with everyone's dedication how meaningful this project really is to them and how special it is. And I think that's only furthering the message of how everybody should be listening to this at least once, you know, like even if you don't want to listen to it on repeat, like you may with like a Broadway cast recording, you definitely need to like go and listen and check it out and read more about it, or even listen to a couple songs, because I really don't think you're going to regret it. And I really think that it's something that everyone should do. So with that being said, I'm actually going to do a drama dictionary right now after the interview, which I usually do not do. And the reason I'm going to do it is because we just talked to Deborah Marsha, who is the assistant conductor over at Tina the Musical. And so I'm going to have our drama dictionary word of the week is actually going to be the overture. And what an overture is right before right when the show starts, this music starts playing, but you're like, wait, the lights are just now becoming black. The curtains aren't going up necessarily quite yet. And the music is playing. So what's going on? Well, that's what is called the overture. And the overture is a combination of, if not all of the song, a bunch of songs, the majority of the songs in the show. And it's kind of like an introduction to like a book, you know, how like they all have like those introductory chapters and or like a table of context almost. And that's kind of it in literally like music form, with no words, no nothing. It's just instruments. And it's a really, really powerful thing. And I love it because not just recently, but like in the older kind of musical cast recordings and everything, they didn't include the overture, but the overture has become such a meaningful and impactful part of the show, and kind of really what kicks the show off and gets everyone in the mood for the show and kind of gives everyone an inside scoop of what they're about to witness, that now it's becoming more and more part of the cast recordings and everything. And I always love going back to the Finding Neverland cast recording and just listening to the overture, because it's one of my favorites. The overture is a really, really important thing. Like I said, it's obviously like anything that starts the show is really important. So I think just starting the show off with that is just a testament to how important it is. And it's just a really beautiful thing of just music. And I think that's like the only time that we can just like just have our relaxation moment, and then boom, it's right into the show, and it's nonstop, fast pace, screaming, singing, yelling, talking, all the things, high action, whatever it is. Yeah, that really is like what starts a musical, of course, that a musical. It's not necessarily in place. So that's what an overture is. And that, folks, is officially all I have for you this week on episode 78 of Take a Bow. Once again, I'm your host, Eli Chokash, and I hope that you all enjoyed this wonderful episode, and I hope that you'll come tune in again next week. I'm now mapping out the month of December for Take a Bow, and oh my gosh, we have a really, really fun lineup for you guys, and I really think that you're going to enjoy, so I definitely know that you guys are going to want to revisit Take a Bow in all of these episodes. So stay tuned and follow us on social media at Take a Bow Podcast. So thank you again for listening, and I hope to see you next week. Bye, everyone. Have a great week. For this episode's curtain call, I would like to recognize a few people who also deserve to take a bow. This podcast would not be possible without the help from Dory Berenstein, Brittany Bigelow, Katie Rosen, Alan Seals, and the team at the Broadway Podcast Network. Next in line to take a bow is Tessie Tokash, who edits the audio and all the visuals for this podcast. A special thanks to patrons Brian Thompson, Pat McNamara, the listeners at PCC, as well as all of the other patrons for their continued support. If you're interested in becoming a patron, go to patreon.com/TAB. And if you enjoyed this week's episode, don't forget to subscribe on the platform that you're currently listening to this on. Also, feel free to give us a follow on Instagram at Take a Bow Podcast. Take a Bow's logo is designed by Giselle Bustos, and the music is by Nikki Torsha and Cormac Collinon. Bye, everyone. Hope to see you next week.
The Outsiders, S.E. Hinton's generation-defining novel, is now a powerful and moving Broadway hit that the New York Post is calling the best new musical of the season so far. Don't miss your chance to join Ponyboy and the Greasers and experience the classic story come to life in a whole new way. The New York Times calls it refreshing, gritty, and endlessly effective. So get your tickets today at outsidersmusical.com, and of course, stay gold. They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway, and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com.